Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. The November-December issue of Science of Mind magazine has been delayed, with their apologies, but there is a sample of the daily pages for that month online, and I will share that with you now. You are not separate from the whole. You are one with the sun, the earth, the air. You don't have a life. You are life. Eckhart Tolle. We say we are one with God and one in God. This is a mistake. We are one of whatever the nature of God is. Whatever it is one. Ernest Holmes, The Philosophy of Ernest Holmes, page 85. And this month's daily guides are written by Dr. Jim Lockhart. And the theme for this month is abundance. The creation of the universe contained within it everything necessary at that instant and the potential for everything that would be necessary for its continued existence and evolution. Nothing was missing. An expression of that universe, you and I are made of the same stuff, that which was present at the instant of creation, that which has come from potential into form during the life of the universe thus far. We also have access to the unlimited potential that has not yet been actualized. Our future is bound in the future of the universe. This rich birthright is available to everyone, is part of everyone, but we must discover it for ourselves. We must find our way, discovering ourselves and our divine natures as we go. Some, it seems, are born into situations where this discovery is highly unlikely, while others, such as you, dear reader, have come into possession of the great truth of self-discovery. Our teaching, Science of Mind, is one source of this truth, built from the wisdom of the ages and expanded through a modern understanding of psychology. Our great gift is that we have this teaching available. To bring these principles to life, we must keep studying the teaching and practicing its principles in our own lives. And the affirmation for the day, I know I am one with the richness of spirit at all times. I accept this as the essential relationship of my life and receive its blessings. And from the Daily Word published by Unity, Inner Peace. The perfect peace of God, Spirit, the universe, is the truth of my life. If I gaze skyward on a cloudy day, it's likely I will see gray skies and may even feel a few raindrops on my face. But I still know that pristine blue sky and sunshine lie beyond those clouds. I remember this when the news and conditions of the world darken the skies of my mind and disturb my peace. The peace and perfection of God, of Spirit, of the universe, is the blue sky and sunshine beyond the clouds of agitation and discord. In prayer, I renew my awareness of the divine presence within and all around me. This is my enduring source of peace that keeps me present to life even as my fortunes shift and the conditions of the world turn troubling. Through it all, God, Spirit, the universe, is unchanging as perfect serenity, love, and harmony. This is my comfort, my joy, and the peace I carry deep in my heart. Joy. The joy of God, of Spirit, of the universe, is mine today and every day. Sometimes I lose touch with my joy. I may be tempted to search outside myself for entertainment or distractions that bring temporary happiness, but when the novelty fades, I find myself searching for joy once again. Today I realize that true, lasting joy has its source in God, in Spirit, in the universe. As a divine being, God's joy is mine. If I'm not feeling joyful, I need not turn to the things of the world. Instead, I need only turn to the divine presence within me. In a moment of prayer and peaceful contemplation, I find deep serenity and peace and the comforting feeling that all is well with me and the world. Worldly happiness may fade. God's joy is my joy forever. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, we are all made delicate. We are all made delicate or we perish. Isn't this the cloth our griefs sew? The hard things break. Soft things bend. The stubborn ones batter themselves against all that is immovable. the flexible adapt to what is before them. Of course, we are all hard and soft, stubborn and flexible, and so we all break until we learn to bend and are battered until we accept what is before us. This brings to mind the Sumerian tale of Gilgamesh, the stubborn, hard king who sought to ask the immortal one the secret of life. He was told that there would be stones on his path to guide him. But in his urgency and pride, Gilgamesh was annoyed to find his path blocked and so smashed the very stones that would help him. In his blindness of heart, he broke everything he needed to discover his way. With the same confusion, we too break what we need, push away those we love, and isolate ourselves when we need to be held most. There have been many times in my life when I've been too proud to ask for help or too afraid to ask to be held. And in the frenzy of my own isolation, like Gilgamesh, I have smashed the window I was trying to open, have slipped the bench I was trying to hammer, and have made matters worse by bruising the one I meant to be tender with. The live bough bends. The dead twig snaps. We are humble to soften from our griefs, or else, in brittle time, become the next thing grieved. Meditate on a situation you are now facing in which you are being hard, stubborn, and resistant. Look at your stubbornness. What are you preserving by being hard? What might break if you continue being resistant? Now look beneath your stubbornness. What do you fear will happen if you bend to the situation? What might be gained by softening? And we return now to the September-October issue for Reverend Dr. Barry Ebert's monthly column and Spiritual Parenting, Tracking Our Children. A while back, while teaching a parenting workshop at a local high school, I asked participants, how many of you are regularly checking your kids' schoolwork online on the parent portal? Almost every hand proudly went up. I then asked how many of your parents were constantly poking their noses into your school business when you were a teenager. No hands. The relationship between parents and teens has changed dramatically in this generation. Our technology gives parents the opportunity to not only look at grades, but also check on whether their kids turned in their homework, passed a quiz, showed up late to class, or missed any assignments. While this may seem like the right thing for a good parent to do, it sends a message that children can't handle the responsibility of school on their own and that they will fail if their parents don't stay on them. It can also cause kids to think, there's no sense both of us worrying about school. My parent will let me know what I need to do. This virtual form of supervision also extends into the teenager's social lives, just as their urge for freedom grows stronger. The most powerful tracking device of all is the cell phone, which can give parents the location of their children and follow their movements. This form of relationship is doomed to fail as the child will eventually figure a way to outwit the tracker, and the cell phone becomes something to be taken away as a punishment. There are so many great advantages to our communication tools to help us stay in touch with our loved ones, but the constant tracking of our children is a double-edged sword. We may think we're helping to keep them safe, but we're setting them up to fail when they leave home if they don't get the opportunity to make decisions and develop their own sense of right and wrong. We want our children to be able to take care of themselves when we're not around, and they learn how to do that by practicing during their teen years. So turn off the tracking devices and let your teens know you trust them. Yes, they'll make mistakes. That's how they grow wiser. And make sure they know you'll always have your phone on if they need to call for help. Reverend Dr. Barry Ebert is an associate minister and the former youth director at Mile High Church in Lakewood, Colorado. And from this same issue, Finding Peace in the Shattered Pieces by Kim Stanwood Terranova. The fire raged and threatened, the winds ferocious, the night my life seemed to fall to pieces. When we were told to evacuate, we listened and moved in focused alignment with the presence. Spirit guided my every step and my every thought. Spirit breathed me through the storm. There I was standing next to my car, dogs loaded in the back seat, engine running, and God said, "Go back in, Kim." I've learned to honor that voice. I live for that voice, and I did not hesitate to follow God's guidance. I walked back into our home and went through every room, praying, blessing it, soaking it in. I deeply appreciated the love we cultivated in the spaces everywhere I looked. Our home was a sanctuary, a retreat center where we hosted countless agape practitioner and ministerial events, initiations, weddings, spiritual retreats, and workshops. The grounds were blessed with years of prayers, meditation, and divine wisdom from so many gifted teachers and soul seekers. Walking down the steps into my office, I felt the wisdom in the walls, the books, notes, and journals filled with deep spiritual knowledge from the journey I'd been on as long as I can remember. I took a breath of appreciation for this love-filled space and heard the voice again. What could you not live without, Kim? My eyes immediately landed on the treasure that lifted and guided me for most of my life, and I said out loud, "This! I cannot live without this!" I pulled my tattered and torn original hardback copy of Ernest Holmes' This Thing Called You off the shelf. My eyes caught another treasure, Reverend Dr. Michael Bernard Beckwith's Spiritual Liberation. I held them in my hands and walked out of my home into the deep darkness and swirling winds. Through the foreboding smoky night I drove, in prayer I drove, the only sounds my heart beating as I spoke my prayers and the panting from the back seat where my two bull mastiffs sat. The night was eerie, something I could not see brewing, and fear knocking. Unbeknownst to me, only a few hours later, the intense Malibu firestorm swallowed up the beautiful safe haven we once called home, our Namaste sanctuary. All that remained of the life we knew so well was smoldering ash, crumbled, charred pieces, with no resemblance to the vibrant existence that illuminated that sacred land for years. It felt apocalyptic. There was no place the eye could see that was not scorched, burned land. The mountains were dark, and thousands of hearts were in shock, including mine and the hearts of my two precious children. The journey from chaos to healing. The journey of healing when your life falls to pieces is an interesting one. It takes enormous courage to face disaster and trauma and not be taken down by the crisis. What I knew then, with my home lost, was that the spiritual tools I possessed would create a foundation for my family to stand on. Although I did not know where we would sleep, where we would get food and clothing, or what steps we would take next, I did know that Spirit knew and would always guide us. I surrendered to deep listening. Amidst the pain and confusion, I listened to God. I prayed, and I listened with every breath. Biblical verses teach us that there is peace in the midst of the storm, and I definitely know that to be true. When we lean into God in the middle of challenges, then we are held through them. The truth is, we are always held, and our acceptance of being held through the turmoil comes from a conscious awareness, a willingness to surrender. We must stay conscious and aware while the crisis is present. This may not be an easy task, yet it is an essential one. Holmes teaches us, if you listen for peace, you will experience it. If you listen for truth, you will hear it. We must choose to listen for peace, even as chaos may be erupting. We must cultivate our listening so we can hear above the noise of the world. When our intention in listening is to understand, rather than listening to be right or to make someone else wrong, then we begin to listen for peace, and ultimately, we experience it. Peace based on oneness. Our peace is not based on circumstances. Our peace is based in the remembrance of our oneness with the divine truth of God, of Spirit, of the universe, which is always consistent and ever-present. We're never separate from God. When our life seems to be in pieces, the presence is still our guiding light. Oneness exists as a spiritual truth in moments of joy and calm, as well as in moments of madness. The presence never leaves us. There are places across the globe right now that seem to be falling to pieces. May we each be willing to cultivate the consciousness of healing while the appearance of chaos occurs. With every spiritual practice we embody, we begin to normalize peace in our lives. With every choice to normalize peace in our lives, we build a culture of peace. As we build a culture of peace, our world begins to put the broken pieces of our families, communities, cities, countries, and continents back together with love. As individuals choose to find the path of peace in the dark moments, we gain strength and the foundation of our world becomes stabilized and illuminated. My life of practice kept us afloat in that dark time. Yes, I felt the depth of loss, the grief, the uncertainty, and many tears flowed. That was not to be denied. It was my portal to deep healing. My willingness to lean into God, to Spirit, to the universe, when things were falling apart, strengthened my faith and built my foundation to create again. What I know for sure is that my consciousness expanded, grew, and evolved through the ashes of the fire. With every step, I chose to rise like the phoenix because my vision and my commitment to my practice was bigger than the problem. God's vision of my life led me onward. As I look out on my land now, I see the rebuilt house that rose up and the new retreat center that rises even now. I hear the voices of those who will come to this sacred land to heal, to celebrate, to evolve into their fullest expression. I experience the evidence of every prayer, every intention, every vision as each comes into full manifestation. The pieces of my life came back through the healing balm of love, faith, and so much practice. Sometimes through the portal of crisis comes the peace of humanity to our doorstep. Coming to peace with living a life of peace beyond circumstances allows us to embrace our oneness and live it in our very actions. I invite us all to rise in consciousness, to hold the vibration of love in the context of our precious and precarious lives. We are here to live what we know, to live awakened lives, and to assist others in doing the same. May we exhibit acts of peace to all, and may we forever release old paradigms of separation. We are in this together, and our opportunity is to lovingly lean into the presence of God, of Spirit, of the universe, hold each other gently, and build a world that honors all. We are the glue to hold and heal the pieces of humanity to peace. Forever we are one with all that is. Peace. Be still. We turn now to the November-December issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication. And the monthly column by Rabbi Ram Shapiro, Roadside Assistance for the Spiritual Traveler. The Simple Truth About Life and Death. I'm attending a memorial service for a friend's dad. She asked everyone to read something. My friend is religious. I'm not. I can't find anything to read that speaks to me or write anything that isn't shallow and trite. Please help me with this. Rabbi Rami. Consider the following as a prompt to be personalized. As long as we have bodies, we have egos, and imagine ourselves to be separate from one another, from nature, and from the greater wholeness some of us call God. However necessary this sense of separation may be, as sages from Buddha to Einstein reveal, it is fundamentally illusory. Your dad no longer suffers from this illusion, but we do. And because we do, we grieve his death. May your tears of grief cleanse your vision that you might see through the illusion and know that you and your dad were and are one now and forever. I recently started practicing holotropic breathing. I lie down blindfolded, listen to loud, bassy music, and breathe to the beat. After a while, I understand your teaching that I am God. Do you teach this? As I understand it, though not as you describe it, holotropic breathwork is a form of pranayama. It should be done with an expert guide trained to help you deal with the positive and negative experiences it can evoke. I lack such training, and hence I don't teach it. Regarding the teaching, I am God, the I here is not your ego, but the infinite non-dual I am. Aya in Hebrew, aham brahmasami in Sanskrit, that manifests as all reality. When your breathwork leads you from I am God to I am is God to I am is everyone to I am is all, and finally to Ein Od Milvado, there is nothing other than I am, Deuteronomy 4:35, then you may begin to understand my teaching. My wife refers to me as her godless wife because I don't study the Bible every day like she does. She insists the Bible is absolute truth. I find this dangerous. Am I wrong? Like your wife, I studied the Bible daily. Like you, I'm skeptical about claims of absolute truth. The Bible is an anthology of books written and edited over centuries by dozens of people, primarily men, and contains conflicting insights and instructions, such as love your neighbor and the stranger, and kill every man, woman, child, and cow of the Amalekites. 2,000 years ago, Rabbi Hillel revealed the heart-wrenching teaching of the Bible as, what is hateful to you, do not do to another. Talmud, Shabbat, 31a. Bible passages that align with Hillel are true. Passages that don't aren't. Studying the Bible guided by Hillel may not make your wife happy, but it will make her Bible less dangerous. I'm an atheist, but when the cashier at my supermarket says, God bless you, have a nice day, I smile politely and say, you too. I feel so hypocritical. What might I say instead? Here are two suggestions. One, since all gods from Krishna to Christ and Allah to Adonai are figments of humankind's primitive imagination, and since life is random and outside my control, I cannot accept your meaningless God bless you and find your demand that I have a nice day absurd and burdensome. So please take my money, bag my groceries, and keep your God and platitudes to yourself. Or, two, you can smile politely, honor her effort to honor you, say you too, and practice getting over yourself. My preschooler pointed to a white Adam in his Sunday school picture Bible and asked, if God made people white, where did black people like us come from? I fear his teacher's answer. What's yours? The ancient rabbis, who were themselves brown, never imagined a white Adam. They said, when God formed Ha-Adam, the earthling, from the dust of Ha-Adama, the earth, God used dust of every color so that the earthling was multicolored. There are no white people in the Bible. Our educational materials and stained glass windows should reflect this. I'm reading your book, Perennial Wisdom for the Spiritually Independent. When you say everything is non-dual, do you mean there are no differences? Are good and evil the same? Non-duality erases separateness, not difference. Good and evil are different. Good enhances the well-being of self and others, and evil diminishes it. Yet they share a common source, Allah, Tao, Brahman, and so on. This is what God reveals to the prophet Isaiah. I create light and dark. I fashion good and evil. The best image of this is the Taoist Taihitu, or yin-yang, representing the interdependence and complementarity of opposites in Taiji, the supreme, ultimate, or absolute non-duality. Humanity has existed for millennia. We've made great strides in killing one another, but almost none in loving one another. How do I spark a global revolution in human love? We need a revolution of consciousness that sees through the illusion of dualism. St. Paul called this revolution putting on the mind of Christ. Zen Master Dogen called it the Buddha way. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be awake to everything. Awake to everything, all division drops away. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace, pure awareness, continues endlessly. The 4th century Rabbi Abaye called this awareness being awake to Shekinah, the divine, manifesting as all reality, and taught that the success of the revolution depends on there being at least 36 revolutionaries. He called them lamed vodniks, or 36ers, awake to Shekinah and active in the world of each moment. The challenge isn't to spark a revolution in others, but to be a lamed vodnik yourself. You promote syncretism, suggesting people explore practices from different religions. Don't religions argue against this? I do promote syncretism, and though religions oppose this, I don't care. I care about truth. Alts is God, Yiddish, and Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma, Chandayoga Upanishad 3.14.1. Everything is a manifesting of God / Brahman. The fact that I experience truth in many traditions only deepens my conviction that it's true. Religions argue against syncretism for the same reasons Coke argues against Pepsi, money and market share. My uncle is a racist and an anti-Semite who never tires of telling us how much he loves Jesus. What can I say to change his mind? Remind him that Jesus was a brown-skinned Middle Eastern Jew. It won't change his mind, but it may mess with it. And from the same issue, Kevin Anderson's The Soul of Therapy, the one word religion needs now. Several years ago, a client told me he'd given up on prayer. When I pray for things, he explained, my prayers are never answered. I told him I could teach him a form of prayer that works every time, but we'd need to let go of thinking of prayer as a vending machine. The reluctance of psychotherapists to address spirituality and religion can be traced back to Sigmund Freud, who wrote, religion is an illusion, and it derives its strength from its readiness to fit in with our instinctual, wishful impulses. Carl Jung, Freud's rebellious disciple, placed spirituality and religion at the center of the human drama when he wrote, among all my patients in the second half of life, there has not been one whose problem in the last resort was not that of finding a religious outlook on life. That view never took hold in psychology. Religion comes from the Latin words re, again, and ligare, to bind. The word's etymology suggests that our connection with the divine easily becomes loose or unbound, and that religious practice re-secures the bond. Today, however, more people are choosing to cut that cord. A 2024 Pew Research Center, PRC, survey found that 28% of adults in the United States are religiously unaffiliated, dubbed the American nuns, N-O-N-E-S, because they check none for religious affiliation on surveys. PRC found that only 29% of nuns reject any notion of God or a higher power, and about half consider themselves spiritual. Many who grew up through the horror of people flying passenger jets into skyscrapers in the name of God, reports of clergy sexual abuse, and the alignment of fervent religious belief with politics more than with justice and compassion have decided religions are more part of the world's problems than a path toward healing them. Some nuns might even agree with Bertrand Russell's assessment in his 1957 book, Why I Am Not a Christian. Quote, it is possible that humankind is on the threshold of a golden age, but if so, it will be necessary first to slay the dragon that guards the door, and this dragon is religion. Unquote. The Dalai Lama may have come to the rescue with his refreshingly simple proclamation, My religion is kindness. This offers a new meaning for religion and challenges any religious system that does not foster kindness. It moves us away from beliefs as the core of spirituality, instead identifying humanity's ultimate higher power as a relational energy that affirms the sacredness and dignity of every person. Kindness affirms a fundamental goodness in others, no matter how different their beliefs are. It binds us to one another and to the divine we see in every human being. The psychologist Abraham Maslow wrote that when great spiritual leaders die, their followers tend over time to turn their core teachings upside down, often because of struggles over power and orthodoxy. What connection, for instance, existed between the Prince of Peace and burning people at the stake during the Inquisition? When religion becomes all about defining and defending orthodox belief, kindness is lost. When belief blocks kindness, religion binds humanity to spiritual warfare, my truth versus your truth, instead of to the divine. We defend religious beliefs because we need our ideas of God to protect us from the existential crisis of having no certain answers to ultimate questions. This has everything to do with fear and nothing to do with kindness. Echoing Jung, I can say that among the thousands of couples I've worked with in therapy, there have been few whose central problem was other than learning to treat each other with kindness. In committed relationships, as in religion, the enemy of kindness is the belief that I am right and you are wrong, that you are the problem. The root of rigid kindness-blocking beliefs is reactivity. The habitual quickness of our well-rehearsed triggers, thoughts, emotions, and behaviors. Kindness is an energy that lives in the gap between stimulus and response. Practicing meeting everything in life with mindful, non-judging awareness allows us to begin choosing our best responses instead of our most reactive ones. And there's nowhere we need this more than in our closest relationships. The intimate partner relationship that we hope will be the balm for wounds incurred in other relationships, family of origin, school, prior partners, becomes for many the most reactive zone in life. Practicing kindness as the core spiritual energy of our most important relationships keeps us humble. My religion is kindness is not a naive feel-good cliche. It is a deep challenge to stop fighting over beliefs about who is to blame and focus on being an instrument of love and kindness to each other. Metta practice, or loving-kindness meditation, involves bringing people to mind and wishing them health, happiness, peace, and all good things. This is the form of prayer I taught my client who'd given up on prayer. It won't magically make anything better for others, but it allows the practitioner to let go of self-focused preoccupations and realign with other-centered kindness. The Dalai Lama's religion of kindness is not a dragon guarding the doorway to humanity's golden age of peace. It is the key to the door. But how will that key be turned, and when will the door open? The very next time you or I treat another human being, a member of our inner intimate circle, or a stranger, with fundamental respect, dignity, and kindness. And Kevin Anderson is a psychotherapist, poet, and writer. His books include Now is Where God Lives, Divinity in Disguise, Noble Nature, and the inconceivable surprise of living. He's father to five and grandpa to one. Visit thewingedlife.com. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on-demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. We return now to Rainn Wilson's Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution. And last week we had started Chapter 4, The Notorious G-O-D. Be still and know that I am God, Psalms 46:10. There is a secret one inside us. The planets and all the galaxies pass through his hands like beads. Kabir. Let's face it. The God of the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament, is more than a little, shall we say, all over the place. This anthropomorphized entity occasionally flies into rages, can be vindictive, envious, and violent, and is filled with irreconcilable contradictions. How could this view of an angry, judgmental creator who's been worshipped, sermonized, studied, and portrayed in countless works of art not seep into our collective Western psychology and subconscious? But back to our story. Fast forward to me in my 20s, having moved to New York to study acting, where I promptly jettisoned anything having to do with God, morality, religion, and spirituality. During my time in New York City, while I attended acting school and the years thereafter, I rejected anything and everything related to spirituality. For a couple of years, I even tried on atheism like some jaunty, rebellious cap. I transitioned to skeptically seeing God as someone or something grandmothers might need to believe in so that they feel better about their lives. Religion was for old conservative types who weren't capable of creating a rich, vital life of their own and needed some outside supernatural belief system to provide structure and meaning in a chaotic world. At the same time, I started to see hypocrisy all around me, in most religionists and even in the Baha'i community. Like a suburban Seattle version of Holden Caulfield, I reacted, however maturely, by thinking, what a bunch of phonies, and I turned away from anything having to do with religion, God, and the faith of my youth, as so many young folks in America's big cities do. This new universe view in place, I promptly threw myself into my acting studies. I spent years studying the craft of theater for 14 hours a day, memorizing Shakespearean sonnets, doing scenes in acting class, and tongue stretches and long vowel sounds in voice and speech seminars, and wearing red noses in clowning workshops. A class, by the way, that would greatly benefit me as Dwight Schrute in later life. But, and this is most important, under the tutelage of Zelda Fickhandler, one of the grand dames of American theater and founder of Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., and head of NYU's graduate acting program, I started to see the pursuit of being an artist as noble and transcendent. Being an actor and a storyteller was a potentially life- and world-changing vocation. We were not just being trained as actors. We were being inspired and cajoled, expanding our view of theater training as more of a mission than anything else. Why was it a mission? Well, because throughout world history there have always been shamans, those who have a deep connection to the spirit world, and that was, in essence, the role that a great actor played. This was a revolutionary idea for me. Usually an actor is simply hired to bring dialogue to life. The director is the puppet master, and the lines themselves are sacrosanct and usually can't be altered. It's the equivalent of being in an orchestra. You play the notes as written on the page, and the conductor makes all the real creative decisions about the piece. But a shaman? Truth be told, we don't actually know what the duty of a shaman was 10,000 years ago. There weren't ring cameras up on the walls of caves documenting what went on when a tribe gathered around the nightly fire. But we do know that the shamans were a combo platter of a lot of different roles. They played the part of truth tellers, certainly. Also, mage, priest, storyteller, mystic, diviner, perhaps a little sprinkling of social commentator, stand-up comedian, and clown. They were part griot, or medicine man, passing down the legends from the past and truths from the ancestors who guide us into the future. Certainly, dancing and singing were incorporated into their ceremonies and presentations. Could there have been a touch of gadfly to the Athenian nation and the role they played? Perhaps, like Lear's fool, they entertained, cajoled, and at the same time had one eye fixed on the mysterious realms beyond. Thinking of an actor as playing this societal role was transformative. I could be a truth-teller, holy man, and fabulous all in one. This idea would be the central guide in our theater training over the coming years, and it has influenced my thinking ever since. Now, you might be rolling your eyes at this juncture, and I wouldn't blame you. As in, wait, how was Dwight a shamanic role? He was just an annoying idiot sitcom sidekick. Don't actors mostly just look pretty and say their lines in a vapid way? Sell beer and cars and tennis shoes on the side? Seek Instagram followers and complain about their agents? Stoke their egos and hold court on things they know nothing about? Yes, true, all of that. But, and hear me out, think about when you see a performance that transcends the ages and becomes a voice of the time. A performance that lifts the story from the banal and traditional to the sublime. A performance that you remember your entire life. That's when we get a glimpse of the actor as shaman. Think of Brando at his best, De Niro in Raging Bull, King of Comedy, or Taxi Driver, Daniel Kaluuya in Judas and the Black Messiah, Frances McDormand in, well, anything. But also think of the times when you've seen breathtaking performances in the theater. Brave, bold, unpredictable, riotously funny, fierce, and I've seen far too many great ones to share here. Sorry to wax pretentious, but in these instances, an actor is far greater, far more revelatory than a hired musician simply playing the appointed notes within the boundaries of a symphonic orchestration. The actor reveals the human condition searingly with truth and fearlessness, humor and vulnerability. So here we were, a bunch of little shaman wannabes in acting school, treading the boards in the world of professional theater. As I continued on my acting journey, casting away my Baha'i past and finding a new, exciting shamanistic religion in the theater, I hit a few roadblocks. Long story short, in the 90s, many of my friends and I were fighting devastating internal battles that really had no name, no way of categorizing them. Today, we recognize and label these as mental health issues. But no one was talking about mental health in 1992, at least no one I knew. Mental health is what Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Leonardo DiCaprio in What's Eating Gilbert Grape were dealing with. Two other shaman-like performances, by the way. But mental health was what I was in battle with in my early 20s. I first went into therapy in 1990 because I was so depressed I couldn't get out of bed. I was frequently beset with anxiety attacks that left me on the ground in a puddle of sweat with a rapid heartbeat, and I was using various levels of drugs, alcohol, porn, food, and whatever else to attempt to escape and numb my feelings. I was lost. And when you can't name something, it becomes even more daunting and overwhelming. This is not the book for me to relay all the ups and downs of my mental health story and its many battles. I reveal a bit more of it in my 2015 comedic memoir, The Bassoon King. The reason I bring this chapter of my life to light in this context, however, is because it was these mental health tests that brought me to seek out a relationship with the Creator in a newly minted way. Or rather, these challenges and the resulting emotional earthquakes forced me to look for a higher power, for a greater sense of meaning and purpose in my life, for balance and perspective, for something bigger than my mixed-up self, for hope. I echo what the great teacher and writer Julia Cameron once said, "Necessity, not virtue, was the beginning of my spirituality." I was no saint being visited by some holy spirit, nor was I some bodhisattva finding enlightenment through intensive contemplation and revelatory insight. I needed to seek spirituality because I was really friggin' unhappy. I would have a lot of conversations with myself. Look at me, my incessant thought spirals would spin. I'm a working actor. Broke, but working. Great girlfriend, now wife. Awesome apartment in Brooklyn, kick-ass van, but I'm so unhappy. Why do I wake up at 3 a.m. and stare at the ceiling? Why do I despise myself so much of the time? Why do I cry myself to sleep on occasion? What gives? Then I continued, was I rash to have thrown out everything and anything having to do with God? People with God in their life sometimes seem happier after all. Maybe I threw the baby out with the bathwater? I started talking to friends about the concept of a creator, but no one really ever wanted to get into it. When I would ask my friends and workmates if they believed in a higher power, after some awkward hemming and hawing and some uncomfortable stumbling silences, they would respond with some version of, kind of, I guess, sort of, maybe. They would say that they certainly didn't believe in the previously referenced Grandpa God with a flowing beard on a cloud with a telescope and an agenda, but they also didn't think that creation was nothing but meaningless molecules bouncing around either. They remained, shall we say, noncommittal about the whole thing. They all kind of believed in God, but their answers were the vaguest, milquetoast answers possible. This didn't work for me. The existence of God was kind of like being pregnant. It is or isn't. You can't be kind of pregnant. I mean, there either needed to be an all-knowing, all-loving, all-seeing creative force behind and above and within everything, or consciousness was purely a random and meaningless accident of an even more random and meaningless assemblage of molecules bouncing around in a random and meaningless physical plane of existence. There's really not much in between these two options. As it says in the AA Big Book, God is either everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. So I went on a journey of spiritual and religious rediscovery. I dug deep into the holy books of the world's great faiths. The Bible, certainly. The Quran, yes. The Baha'i books that I had noticed on my parents' bookshelf, but had never cracked open as a teen. But also the Bhagavad Gita of Hinduism and the Dhammapada and other teachings of the Buddha. And finally, some books that truly changed my life. The Gospel of the Red Man, The Sacred Pipe, Black Elk Speaks, God is Red, and many other mystical but accessible tomes about Native American spirituality. Books, by the way, that dove even deeper into the meaning of the role of the shaman. It was there, at long last, that I read about a conception of God that was going to change my life. Wakan Tanka, a title for God in the Lakota Sioux tradition, a concept that led me on a road to ever greater understanding and helped me steer very gradually out of the vortex of my mental health struggles. But before I dig more specifically into this life-altering spiritual discovery, there's a lot of ground I want to cover in this chapter's quest to reimagine, explore, and explode this concept of the notorious G-O-D. First, I want to begin with a shout-out to the atheists. Yo, atheists! In case you were wondering, this section is not going to be like one of those videos where a God believer and an atheist sit on a stage in front of a partisan audience who already have their minds made up and have an argument about whether God exists or not. Those discussions are pointless. Just read the comments section underneath the videos. No one has ever changed their mind about something as colossal as the Supreme Being because of who scored more points in an argument on YouTube, no matter how articulate the speakers might be. I'm not here to change anybody's mind, just to provide some, hopefully, interesting, fresh perspectives. I absolutely love, admire, and respect atheists. Seriously, if I wasn't a dyed-in-the-wool theist, I would definitely go back to being an atheist. Why? Because atheists, by and large, love science and its method of understanding the universe. And I can totally relate, because I love science too. I certainly don't consider science to be in any kind of opposition to faith and spirituality. That's the epitome of a false dichotomy. Both are effective, albeit different, modalities for understanding the same ultimate reality. Science is an incredible methodology and set of tools for studying the material world. Through its systematic focus, it has unlocked, especially over the past two centuries, what one could consider miracles. The quality of our lives has been made infinitely better thanks to it. He says, drafting this book on his laptop, on which he can watch videos of cats playing the piano, calculate advanced math equations, research anything that has ever existed ever, record music tracks, schedule his calendar down to the minute, listen to podcasts about beekeepers, and talk face-to-face in crystalline clarity with someone in Mongolia. Science. I mean, who doesn't love the systematic study of the structure and behavior of the physical and natural world through observation and experimentation? Unfortunately, throughout the ages, science has frequently been positioned as being in opposition to faith. If one looks at a thumbnail history of God, he, God, was an ever-present figure with us, Homo sapiens, appearing in various incarnations, both pantheistic and monotheistic, since the dawn of humanity. Every Homo sapiens culture has some kind of relationship with a divine power that exists beyond space and time, a relationship that many believe helped early civilizations answer questions about the world that couldn't be answered in any other way. This historically is called the God of the Gaps. Anything science can't explain is God or is of God. We early humans don't know where that scary-sounding thunder comes from. Well, let's put a divine face or label on it, and by creating a god of thunder, like Thor, Norse, or Baal, Phoenician, or Set, Egyptian, boom, problem solved. See what I did there? The answer to the mysterious noise must be there's a powerful being in the sky that occasionally gets angry and makes a thunder crash with his hammer or sword or what have you. Then, eventually, through the tools of science, we humans discovered that thunder comes from the rapid expansion of the air surrounding the path of electrically discharged through a lightning bolt, and all of a sudden, there's no longer any need for Thor or Baal or Set. The powerful God is then relegated to colorful ancient mythology, and science holds the new explanation for said phenomenon. Some religious folk would continue to draw this God of the Gaps idea forward to the modern day and say, using the example of some event we don't have an explanation for as of yet, well, since we don't have a clue how life started on planet Earth or how a bunch of chemicals and molecules suddenly transformed into single-celled organisms and bacteria, their de facto creation must be God's fingers zapping the oceans of our planet billions of years ago. However, to the materialist, naturalist, person of science, everything can ultimately be explained by a scientific theory. So it's not that we don't know the answer to why chemicals and molecules evolved into live organisms 4 billion years ago. We simply don't know the answer yet. Now, of course, this whole paradigm is ridiculous. It pits religion versus science in an incredibly simplistic way. Everything proven belongs to science, and all things mysterious and undiscovered belong to God. No. God is either within and without and interwoven throughout all of nature and natural phenomenon, or there is no supernatural presence whatsoever, and there is only matter, energy, and their physical laws bobbing and throbbing about purposelessly in a vast, empty space. Again, it's impossible to stereotype an entire population based on what they believe, but on the whole, I think it's safe to say that atheists are naturally skeptical. As a whole, they try not to inherit beliefs handed down from their childhood, culture, media, or family. They pride themselves on examining things with an eye on the individual investigation of truth and demand to be shown proof, usually repeatable and provable. Those admirable, sometimes pesky atheists delight in knocking down sacred shibboleths, challenging all assumptions about the supernatural. The reason they reason things out on their own, with their own eyes, their own brains. I greatly admire these traits and attempt to hold myself to the same exacting skeptical standard. We all should. In fact, I would say that if you blindly and incuriously believe in any religious faith, especially the faith of your parents, you're kind of an idiot. There, I said it. Atheists have rejected so many of the obvious hypocrisies, corruptions, and especially nonsensically literal interpretations of symbols and metaphors in most of the world's religions. At tremendous risk of pissing off every single religious faith in the world, I would simply offer you some examples of these superstitions. Elephant-shaped gods. The reincarnation of bad human beings into cockroaches. People turned willy-nilly into pillars of salt. Magical enlightenment under trees. Burning bushes that talk to you. Jesus' body floating away after 3 days to be with his dad. Muhammad riding a winged horseback and forth to Jerusalem in a night. Besides all the mythological stories, atheists have so many very good reasons to not believe in God. For instance, from the dawn of time, religion has caused innumerable wars and incalculable deaths, all in an all-loving God's name. From the Crusades to the mass exterminations of non-believers during the first centuries of colonialism to the Spanish Inquisition, from 9/11 to the Iran-Iraq War to Hindu mob violence against Muslims in India to armed Buddhist terrorists setting off bombs in Sri Lanka. No religious faith has escaped this violence, not to mention the endless list of holy genocides, holy wars, and holy pogroms that have preceded recorded history. And let's not forget that God people seem to be so weirdly anti-science at times. I mean, why this recent bizarre connection in evangelical circles between believing in Jesus and disbelieving in vaccines? God worshippers frequently seem to just believe in stuff that makes little to no sense, and they never seem open to investigating the truth for themselves. They then label this as having faith. Also, God, as we have come to understand him through the Abrahamic mythology, is so toxically male. It's patriarchy personified. Big, disapproving, bearded, warlike, anthropomorphic, masculine, daddy man, who is going to spank you with plague or lightning or locusts or damnation if you don't do his bidding. A ton has already been written about how the glorious ancient feminine and matriarchal spiritual traditions were stomped down and shoved aside to make way for this domineering patriarchal conception, and how the suppressive religious patriarchy focused more traditional roles on women, which in most cases, for countless generations, kept our innately powerful women subservient, abused, and undereducated. Also, in so many faith traditions, God seems narcissistically obsessed with people bowing down and worshiping him and sending those who don't do so to burn in the fiery pit of hell for all eternity, which, by the way, is a very, very long time. What a jerk. I mean, who does that? Like I said, it makes total sense to reject some or all of this God nonsense. The simulation hypothesis. Interestingly, atheists have come up with a cutting-edge theory of their own that is one of the most spiritually minded tools for viewing the totality of reality ever invented. It folds beautifully into Christianity and Buddhism and connects science and religion into a feasible and awe-inspiring speculation. I'm speaking of the simulation hypothesis, of course, popularized by Elon Musk and Neil deGrasse Tyson, subject of the popular A Glitch in the Matrix documentary, potentially believed in by millions, a supposition that can be embraced by theists and atheists around the globe. This simulation theory basically postulates that we're all living in a perfect simulacrum of a three-dimensional universe, and that when we die, in actuality, we are ending our relationship to the illusory world that seemingly surrounds us, and we then wake up in our real bodies in the real universe. In other words, what, how, and where we have been living, our flesh tuxedos walking around on good old planet Earth, is like the Matrix and Avatar combined. Our bodies are virtual avatars, and the world outside our windows is a hyper-advanced 3D simulation of real life. For many who engage in such a belief system, this entire apparatus of reality is overseen by a giant supercomputer, or AI, that keeps track of each individual in the midst of their computer-generated sensory, illusory experience. This infinite digital overload also oversees the real world that one wakes up into following death. It backs up our souls on the much more real cloud in servers that are above and beyond the limited space-time continuum of this plane. Sounds suspiciously like another way of thinking about the notorious G.O.D., no? In fact, this template of the illusion of reality syncs up perfectly with many religious traditions. The Imam Ali says in a famous hadith, sacred saying, from Islam, "People are asleep as long as they are alive. When they die, they wake up." In other words, this saying uses the exact same metaphor of life as a dream, with death being an awakening from that dream slash illusion into a completely new reality. You may have heard of the term Maya, the ancient Hindu concept for the illusion of the material world. It also refers to the illusory nature of any kind of duality between the physical and spiritual realm. Maya, as far as I can grasp this incredibly complex and nuanced concept, means not only illusion, but magic, and also has a sprinkling of the definition of foolishness in it. Shankara, the great Hindu philosopher, once used the example of the rope and the snake as an allegory of Maya. You're walking down the road at dusk and you see a snake in front of you. Your pulse quickens and you start to panic, but then you realize the snake is actually a rope. You've seen through the illusion, and as your breath stabilizes, you are back in reality. That is Maya, and it is applicable to the world we see around us. Maya is also frequently seen, especially in Advaita Vedanta, the predominant Hindu philosophical branch, as an illusionary way of seeing the world that is personally summoned from the worst facets of our own selves. It can be thought of as the clouds of selfishness that obscure the reality of the sun. When we contemplate our true spiritual nature and do selfless acts, only then will the clouds of ego disperse, allowing us to witness the beautiful power and purity of the sun. Then we are in Brahma and no longer in Maya. Brahman, which is in opposition to Maya, is the true spiritual reality of everything, the cosmic soul or universal spirit of all creation. Yet another way of conceiving the notorious, G-O-D, perhaps. Although there truly is no duality between the two, no either or, in my feeble understanding of Vedic thinking, there is no material versus spiritual. All is spiritual. The material world, a manifestation of the divine, simply magically tricks us into thinking that it's the only game in town. The idea is foundational in the Baha'i faith as well. Baha'u'llah says, "Verily I say, the world is like the vapor in a desert, which the thirsty dreameth to be water, and striveth after it with all his might, until when he cometh unto it, he findeth it to be mere illusion." Abdu'l-Bahá, Baha'u'llah's eldest son, a Baha'i leader and great spiritual teacher, says, "Know thou that the kingdom of God is the real world, and this nether place is only its shadow stretching out. A shadow hath no life of its own. Its existence is only a fantasy and nothing more. It is but images reflected in water." In other words, we're physically living in the equivalent of a mirage, a vapor, a vision, a shadow, a fantasy. And the spiritual world, which we will all end up in, is true reality, or the real world. All roads lead to the simulation hypothesis. Well, we will continue with Rainn Wilson's book in the coming weeks. Very interesting stuff floating around in his mind that he shares with us. And as always, as we come to the end of our program, I ask if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact the station and ask them to contact me either by calling me or emailing me, and then I can include your questions on the program. And as always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.